My name is Hannah Rosen. I'm a writer for The Atlantic and an editor at Double X, Slate's women's section. And today I'm talking to Anne Friedman, who's deputy editor at The American Prospect and also an editor at Feministing. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Hannah.
And we're both in Washington, and we are going to talk about three topics today. One is Michelle Obama's controversial, or maybe not controversial, trip to Spain with her daughters. The other is Ross Douthat's column today about marriage. It's the latest iteration in the redefining of American marriage. And finally, we're going to talk about my cover story in The Atlantic last month called The End of Men, which Anne Friedman has written about in The Prospect. Mm-hmm. So let's start talking about Spain. So, Anne, you just want to summarize a little bit what has happened? This was in Maureen Dowd's column this weekend, and sort of what have people been saying or not saying about the trip to Spain?
I mean, what has happened is Michelle Obama took a vacation without her husband and with only one of her daughters in a time of recession. And I don't know. I mean, I guess the main talking point is that this is bad optics. I keep seeing that in scare quotes everywhere to take an international vacation during a recession. And so I think that's the broadest overview I can give.
Right. You know, I have to say, me personally, that phrase bad optics, I feel, is such an incredible lazy journalistic cop out. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like when I used to work at the Washington Post, there were certain phrases that you were not allowed to use, like some have said, or, you know, things in which you define the criticism in this kind of meta way. Like, we are the optics, right?
Right.
So, like, we can't accuse somebody or something of bad optics because we, the journalists, control the optics. So, like, it's either a bad thing or a good thing. It's not, you know, the bad optics. It's like she shouldn't do it because it doesn't look good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a passive construction, essentially.
Exactly. It's passive construction. And I actually, you know, before we even start with the optics, I have to say that many of the details of the story, like actually the facts of the story, are not that well known. Like, the mm-hmm. Obamas haven't really responded, and the, you know, whether she went, this initially comes from a New York Daily News, one of these kind of like rousing populist stories, which one, if one doesn't like the president, writes about the president's vacation pretty routinely. You know, like in a time of crisis, like when is not a time of crisis when you're the president? And so, like, we don't know whether she went with 40 people or just a few people and a lot of security detail. Like, that's mm-hmm. not known, right?
Right.
Nor do we know very much about this hotel, which I actually looked it up, and it seems that the rooms range. It does look, you know, pretty awesomely posh, but, it, you know, you could get a room for $400 or you can get a room for $2,000, you know?
I mean, what I can't get over is, like, is it any news that the First Lady travels in style anywhere? I mean, if she were summering, if she were summering 45 minutes from home, wouldn't it also be somewhere posh? I mean, our presidents are rich people, you know?
Well, it's interesting, like, Bush did not vacation rich. I mean, you vacation, I guess, according to your style. Like, Bush was criticized for vacationing excessively, but not necessarily vacationing poshly, you know? And so, you know, I myself took an international vacation with my children. It seems okay.
How lavish.
Exactly. What a posh lady am I. But, mm-hmm. But you know, so there's two things to consider. One is, like, the, you know, this expectation that we have now that celebrities and, you know, the criticism of her is like, oh, isn't she a celebrity? But the other side of that is, like, you know, this new expectation we have that celebrities and political people behave like us, you know, that mm-hmm. they sort of behave, that they do what we do, that in times of crisis she should go take a vacation in her backyard garden
right.
like the rest of us, you know.
Stay here.
Imagine if Jackie O had taken a trip to Europe, like mm-hmm. that would have been awesome, you
right.
know.
Right. Well, there's this tension, you know, we want our political figures to be celebrities on some level, and like mm-hmm. the Obamas are the perfect test case for that. But mm-hmm. then when they act like celebrities, everyone's indignant, you know.
Right. Right, right. And you sort of want them to be good ambassadors overseas, and you want her to be glamorous, and we want to be proud of her glamour, but then suddenly it's, you know, it's a sort of appalling when she actually acts out. And, you know, frankly, I'm thinking, poor woman, like, you know, she just wants to, probably she would love nothing more than to just take her daughters to Spain and go have a cool trip in Spain, but instead she's got to drag these, you know, security detail, and, you know, she can't basically walk out her front door without being surrounded by lots of people. It doesn't seem fun to me at all.
And then there's the whole narrative of, like, how could she have left her husband on his birthday? I mean, everyone in America got an email saying, wish Barack Obama happy birthday. I mean, I don't think that, like, she... Right. She
is not her, lonely on his birthday.
Right, her absence will not be felt too much.
Exactly. Now that is the, you know, that's the classic conversation we could have, is sort of what is expected of a first lady as first lady. Like, mm-hmm. in a way, you know, this hasn't really been spoken, like, this has played out as a populist story, but this does play back to the old stories about Michelle Obama and whether she's sufficiently supportive, you know,
right.
like, is she there for him in the times of, I don't know why this is a time of need, I say that again, you know, but is she there for him, you know, in this moment when he could use her, which is his mm-hmm. birthday, you know, I don't know, and I suppose we have nothing, you know, in terms of model of first lady, like, you know.
Right. Well, I think the justification of the expense for all of her security is easier if she's got a job, if she's got a defined role. And, you know, this was a great piece that Dana Goldstein wrote for The Prospect ages ago, you know, the case mm-hmm. for paying the first lady and making it the job that it actually is.
Right.
And you know, and again, yeah, if we're spending the resources for security detail and all of that, we might as well, you know, actually call it what it is. It's a job.
Right, it is a job. And therefore what? How does the vacation fit into that? If your first lady is a job, then you just get a normal vacation like anybody else, and you're allowed, like the rest of us, like you're allowed 2 weeks out of the symbolism of first lady. Like, you can take a break. You can take a vacation from your job like anybody else, and so then it would count as a proper vacation and not as optics.
Yeah. And then it's justifiable that we count it up the way we counted Bush's vacation days, the way we count Obama's, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the final thing to discuss about this is, what's your sense of her popularity? You know, whether her, I feel like, I remember the stories last summer when she had this real dip in popularity and people kind of hashed that out. And in this, because I'm not actually really sure if this is entirely a media creation. I mean, I looked at all the comments on their stories, and certainly there were many comments with many opinions, but I can't actually tell if this is indicative of some sort of cultural turning on her, or it just has no meaning outside this little blip of should she have taken a vacation.
I mean, I don't know if anyone's turning on her. I think that there's, like, a lot of women in the spotlight. There's this sort of dual, you know, ooh, doesn't she look great? Check out this outfit. And then, oh, how could she? You know, there's sort
right.
of, like, both of those things are happening at once. And
right.
I think that what I've read and what, you know, what people have said to me about it, you know, like, I was talking to a friend of mine who did exactly that. Who said, you know, oh, did you see those photos? That one shoulder outfit, blah, 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 blah. And
right, right.
she looks so good. And then, you know, and then turned right around and was like, and we spent how much money? So,
right.
Which is exactly how we feel, like I said, about celebrities. It's like the same old.
right. And you can't win because you're supposed to look glamorous, but you're not really supposed to look glamorous. So maybe what we could do is, you know, you and I could devise a slideshow of, like, the perfect sort of outfit which seemed to travel appropriate but not excessively glamorous, and that's what the First Lady should be wearing on her trip.
You know, I don't think it's just possible. You can't
It's
win.
Not possible. It's just too much sheen. Well, let's leave the First Lady and her vacation to talk about another topic, which is also based on a New York Times op-ed today, which is Ross Douthat's op-ed from this morning about marriage, in which he redefines it as he's trying to sort of fine-tune the definition, as he often does, kind of away from the conservative Neanderthal definition into a slightly more enlightened definition, but which still kind of preserves the core of excluding gays. So do you want to try and summarize what he actually was trying to say? Because it is a little bit confusing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I had a hard time with it, too. I mean, I think it's kind of convoluted. I mean, what I came away with, and there was a part that I clipped here where he says that opponents of marriage equality are actually defending a particular vision of marriage rooted in a particular tradition that establishes a particular sexual ideal. So it's like, marriage is whatever Ross Douthat says it is. Says
right.
it is. You know what I mean? And I guess that, you know, you're right that he's sort of saying it's not, you know, they're not making the argument anymore that, you know, gay couples are less loving or less able to raise children. It's just sort of, you know, well, you know, there's a particular way of doing things. I don't want to say it's better, but maybe it's better. I mean, I don't know. I found it all very nebulous.
It was pretty nebulous, and I think that it doesn't really address the problem, which is what I was hoping it was. It's like, okay, so marriage is not this, you know, universal, has always been the same. That's the, like, absolute crudest form of the conservative argument, pro-marriage argument. And we all accept that marriage has taken many different forms over history, you know? Mm-hmm. But then Ross tries to move the bar, and in fact, his distinction is completely arbitrary. I mean, the real problem with modern marriage is that, you know, since the 18th century, we have had this thing called the love marriage. You know, that was an incredibly radical idea when it was first introduced, or, you know, not first introduced, there wasn't like a bill saying, here comes the love marriage, but slowly as it developed over time since the 18th century, and here I'm cribbing from Stephanie Kuntz's great book, Marriage, A History, which I've read and quoted several times for several different reasons, you know, love marriage is unstable. There's no getting around that. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a conservative and you want to go back to some fake era called the traditional marriage, you're going to have to basically precede the love marriage if you're going to find a time in which marriage was more stable, you know? Mm-hmm. And even then, as I wrote this morning, plenty of people gotten divorced in the Roman and the Greek era. You know, Stephanie Kuntz writes about that too. Like, people always complain that marriage is unstable. But in truth, marriage, once it became based on choice and love, is very unstable. Mm-hmm. And, or, you know, somewhat unstable, more unstable than it was before. And I don't think anybody, you know, I don't know if you're a conservative what you do with that. I mean, you basically have to draw your line in the sand. Like, am I going to accept it or am I not going to accept it? You know, there is no traditional marriage, you know, starting around the 18th century. So you're kind of left with no argument.
Well, he has this whole part in there, too, that's, you know, heterosexual marriage is about sort of transcending biology for both people involved and, you know, making these sacrifices. And it just, for me, the leap that, you know, a same-sex couple is also not making sacrifices or transcending, you know, base sexual urges or, like, you know, disciplining themselves to stay in this relationship. Just, I mean, it holds no water. I mean, I just don't understand how heterosexuals do that any differently. I don't think he even began
than homosexuals.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's what was so confusing about the column, because you had this whole lead up and then you got to the end and then it seemed to say, like, yes, if we believe all this, then, you know, gay marriage is the first thing we should do. But in fact, we should hold out one last tiny hope of, you know, clinging to traditional marriage, and the kind of extraneous word in that sentence was traditional heterosexual marriage. Like, everything that he was saying, if you believed it up to that point, you know, okay, fine, you want to be on the train of traditional marriage, that's fine, but the heterosexual word was kind of, you know, extraneous in that sense.
I mean, he almost admits what he wants to ban is serial monogamy.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, so, fine. I mean, if you want to ride that train, like, ban serial monogamy for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can see where his position is coming from. Yeah. It just, it's like parallel to the argument of gay marriage. They don't have anything to do with each other. No serial marriage for anyone. Fine. Yeah. Like, then get really, I mean, this is true of Christian conservatives in general, who I've written a lot about. Like, the big problem for marriage is divorce. It's not gay marriage. Like, the problem is that it's relatively, I mean, if you're worried about marriage, then do something about divorce laws, right? But people don't effectively want to sort of grapple with the idea of kind of choice and love, which is what ruined marriage. So, you know, go state by state and ask for it to become more difficult for people to get divorced.
Right.
You know, that's what you should be doing if you believe in marriage. Anyway, so how can you talk a little bit about how it fits into the larger the strategy of this case, which is not, you know, people around the country think, like, awesome for gay rights, but in fact, within the community, there's a lot of debate about whether this was the right thing to do and whether the timing was good. And Slate is about to run several pieces hashing it out, as I'm sure you guys are, but just give me a sense of how it fits in.
I mean, you're talking about with the Prop 8 trial in general.
Yeah, with the Prop 8 trial in general, yeah.
I mean, what I think is interesting about this column is that it, and what was interesting about the trial in general is that it it's hard to find folks who are going to make some of those really, really bigoted arguments against gay marriage in such a bald-faced way anymore. And you know, trying to find witnesses, you know, there was a whole debate about whether there could be cameras in the courtroom because witnesses were afraid that if they stood up and said, you know, we think gay people are bad parents or whatever their beliefs are that are not actually backed up by research, that they would be subject to hate mail and that sort of thing. And so I think, you know, we're seeing this, I don't know, the anti-gay marriage movement is having to reconsider its talking points. And you know, and I do think, you know, Paul Waldman wrote about this in The Prospect recently, that the fact that it's about the effect it'll have on straight people. It all comes back to straight people, which, I mean, I would argue it always...
What do you mean it's the effect it has on straight people?
Well, you know, that, you know, if we open the door to, like, you know, to calling same-sex marriage the way any marriage is, then, you know, essentially it's condoning all the stuff that Ross doesn't like. Serial monogamy and whatever, and polygamy, these are crazy extrapolations they make. But but that it degrades it degrades the heterosexual institution of marriage to expand or change their what they see as the definition in any way.
Right.
And I do think that the narrative around that is something that they're going to continue to struggle with as opinion shifts. And I also think that the ruling in this case, which is sort of said marriage is marriage, and there is no heterosexual marriage versus gay marriage. Like, gay marriage is a figment. There's just marriage.
Right.
Was actually really, I don't know, does not bode well for them as we continue.
Now, I just want to go back with you and do a thought experiment, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the big problem with the kind of ban gay marriage side in this case is that, as you said, they're experts, and this is not like a, you know, liberal argument, it's just universally considered true, were not respectable, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was that guy who turned up with the escort and the suitcase. Like, they did not have, you know, and then they had David Blankenhorn, who they had over and over again. But the research is not good. So the question is, as a legal thought experiment, if you were going to try and create a better side, a better argument, could it be done? Like, could you actually mount a more, you know, reasonable effort to counteract gay marriage? Like, I was a little bit surprised that they couldn't do any better. Like, was it genuinely out of fear? You know, was it that the social science is entirely not there? Like, surely you could have come up with, you know, a study. I mean, you could have come up with something, and so that's a little bit of a mystery to me.
I mean, I think when you're having an argument based on facts, that's what's hard about it. You know, I mean, I can argue, with my more conservative family members who oppose gay marriage on religious grounds all day long, because we're talking about, you know, what they want to happen in their church.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, once you take it into the courtroom, I think it gets harder and harder. And I don't know. I mean, as a thought experiment, I don't think it is a thought experiment. I think that's how it is. I don't know if there's a better argument. And, you know, and granted, I have, you know, maybe you have to pose that question to someone who has different beliefs than I do.
Right.
I'm the best spokesperson.
It's more sort of a mercenary lawyer who has to answer this question
than
somebody with a different belief, because the belief people seem to be getting in their own way. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you hired a lawyer somebody else could do better with, sort of what we want to come up with, what
mm-hmm.
social science, sort of how you want to construct the argument so it doesn't seem, you know, based on nothing.
Right.
But that's not for me to do. Okay, well, let us move on to the definition of marriage, to our final topic, which is my End of Men piece, which ran in The Atlantic, which I will quickly summarize. I basically wrote that that we're moving into an era in which gender roles are radically shifting, and in which women are, you know, thriving in many ways and men are not thriving. And I talked about, you know, connecting certain points of social science research, like graduation rates and sex preferences and then the workforce and various points in America and elsewhere in the world. So, and you wrote a critique of it. Do you want to summarize the critique or just, you know, focus on one part of it?
I mean, I guess, I sort of felt that the conclusion that, you know, this does not bode well for men, was a little misplaced in that, it was sort of based on this assumption that current gender roles in terms of which industries are male-dominated and which are female-dominated, which sectors are growing, how the different genders, like, fare in you know, the education realm and that sort of thing are, I felt it sort of operated on this assumption that these things are going to be unchanging. And I guess my feeling is that rather than sort of saying, you know, men are over, women are ascendant, it's sort of taking a bit of a more holistic look and looking at how things have evolved over time and sort of say, you know, sure, this means that, you know, fields that are male-dominated are struggling right now, but that doesn't mean it's bad for men. That means men have to adapt.
Right.
We have to drastically reconsider, gender roles and stereotypes, which, you know, I mean, I argue is not a new phenomenon. I mean, there is something about, watching Mad Men that I love on that effect, because it's not like, this idea that, you know, the women are ascendant and are about to take over. I mean, this is decades and decades old. And some of the quotes in your piece I thought were really fascinating to that end. You know, a lot of kind of nebulous comments from men that, like, the women run everything now. And, you
right.
know, and I, which is obviously not true. So.
Right. Well, let me hone in on the argument a little bit. So is the, because I've gotten like a universally negative response, I would say, from both feminist writers and kind of, well, men's rights people, but they're a different category. And
well, so you declared a whole gender over, Hannah.
Exactly, I know that. But they do it, but that's an that's actually a separate conversation, because they, the men's rights people would not actually take issue with any particular
right.
thing that I said, you
right.
know, because they actually say all of those same
right.
things. I think it's just the fact that it's a woman saying them, or that it has a sort of, you know, they perceived it to have a tone of glee, which, you know, whatever. it wasn't that gleeful.
I didn't perceive that.
So it was fairly somber in my estimation. But so is the objection to the fact that it's a zero sum, like that I put it out to be a zero sum game, mm-hmm. or is it more this idea that women are obviously not in charge, and so, you know, so we're kind of, I'm declaring this sort of way too quickly, and actually men, you know, so this is just kind of a pause. It just kind of looks bad for men now, but they will soon rise up again. I mean, what's the better?
I mean, I think both of those things are true. I mean, for me, you know, I like that your piece looked across the socioeconomic spectrum, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
when we don't just look at corporate, if we look at the top, if we look at corporate boards and, you know, political power and, you know, the people who are making, like, big decisions for, like, our country and our society,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty unobjectionable that men aren't over. So, you know, like, that on that framing, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, I object.
Right.
But I do think it's important, you know, and this is one thing I did like about your piece, that it considers, you know, broader swaths of the working world, and you know, and considering things like childcare versus manufacturing versus, you know, education.
Right, right. I mean, the objection, that's the first thing people always say, is that the piece, you know, obviously if you look at the top, and I feel like, yes, obviously if you look at the top, women are not completely in charge.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you believe that those things are based on basically kind of, there's no inherent reason. Like, you know, that Darwinian stuff just sort of rankles me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I'm actually writing a book about this, and that will, I'll get into that, which I didn't really in the piece. Like, there's no inherent, you know, in sociological research and anthropology, there's no inherent reason why men dominate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe we could agree on that, right? There's
mm-hmm.
nothing inherent about men that causes
sure.
them to be dominant. I mean, there are sort of structural problems like childcare, and there's sort of the way things have always been done. So if there's no structural thing, then what you have is basically a lot of, you know, optics, to go back to our word. You know, you have this sort of, it's been perceived that way, and you have social roles. You have things that women have done and things that men have done. But
mm-hmm.
it's not immutable. It's just the way things have been. And so then you take, you know, you take the other classes, and you start to see this shift. I mean, if our notions of masculinity are defined, you know, middle class, working class, yes, those people are not the top, so they can't really affect policy. But there, I feel like things have shifted so radically
mm-hmm.
and are shifting so radically that, you know, it just seems inevitable. At some point you just have the image of women in the way people intimately know gender relations just isn't the same. You know,
mm-hmm.
who commits crimes, like who does, you know, who is, you know, who does what in a marriage. Like, those things are changing so rapidly that it just feels to me like a matter of time before the other things kind of catch up.
I mean, I feel like, I don't know about the crime statistics, but I do feel like the notions of who does what in a marriage have been changed for a long time, especially at lower socioeconomic levels. Like, and I don't know whether that's research that we're just getting now, but the notion of, you know, a female breadwinner or, you know, maybe is sort of heightened by the recession and the industries that are most impacted by it, but I don't really see that as like a new phenomenon, and I don't think that necessarily translates to the other types of power, you know, whatever, like we were talking about before, political.
Like big power. I mean, to
yeah.
me, it has definitely been happening for a long time. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if it were happening for 5 years, it wouldn't be interesting. So it has been happening for sort of 34 years,
mm-hmm.
and then now suddenly it's reached some kind of critical mass where, you know, if you look at the working class particularly, it really does look like a matriarchy. It's not that women are happy or like it's not gleeful, as somebody criticized me being. It's just a fact. Like, the men are sort of strangely powerless. In that class. Now, the middle class is a different story because, you know, you have a kind of evenness, you know, in terms of breadwinning, in terms of what women do, in terms of what kind of jobs women hold. So that's a little bit of a different picture until you look at the college rates, which again, that's been happening for a long time. That's been happening since the 80s, that, you know, women reached parity and then started to, to become a higher percentage of graduates. But it just seems significant. It's like, how else do you make sense of all these statistics? And then ultimately the top just looks like an anachronism. I mean, it just looks like, you know, something left over from some other time. Why would it be that way? Why would it continue to be that way? It really doesn't make any sense.
Well, it just goes to show that, you know, like a cross-class argument when you're talking about gender is, like, is really difficult. And, you know, and maybe I wouldn't have had such a strong reaction to the piece if you know, what it sort of said, look, this is about working-class America, like, period. You know, I mean, and sort of, like, made that, like, a little bit more...
Because the idea is that it stops at the top, and that's actually a stopgap. Like, that's not that's not something that ultimately shifts. It's just a stopgap.
Mm-hmm.
See, it seems to me like the structural problems we have at the top, which have to do with sort of child, like, you have to admit, either you have to think that the only reason that men control the top is because they're, you know, hardwired to control the top,
mm-hmm.
like they are, you know, inherently dominant. Otherwise, then why is it such a powerful force? Like, what is it that keeps men at the top and not women at the top?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with childcare and family dynamics. Like, I think it's a way that, you know, that homework is organized. Like, I think that would be a primary factor. And there's some research that says that, and a lot of that is just when I look around, why I see so...
What do you mean homework is organized? That's interesting.
I think it's like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's biological. You know, women have kids, and therefore are blah, blah, blah. But I do think that the expectation on women to devote more time to the home sphere, even if they are incredibly, like, career-oriented or, like, headed on that path to the sort of political and business, upper echelons.
Right.
You know, even if they're on their way up there, that the pressure to be home-focused, or at least more home-focused than men, is really, really strong.
Right.
And some of that is also coming from, you know, that's from women themselves, too. I mean, I don't think that's all, you know, husbands saying you must stay home or anything like that. I think it's a broad, powerful force.
Right. But do we think that that broad, powerful force is, you know, changeable? I mean, surely we would want that to change. I mean, that's the part where I think that, you know, feminists and the argument would be in alliance. Like, we don't want that. I mean, what we want, you know, we don't do radical experiments the way Scandinavian countries do because we don't legislate that way. But, you know, what we would want ideally is a situation where, you know, something like Sweden, where you force it down the men's throats. I mean, where you just force this notion that men, you know, that the roles are not, you know, immutable, that people have to learn to behave in certain ways. So if you're a macho guy in Sweden, like, you've got to take off whatever kind of, you know, paternity leave you want.
Yeah.
Even if this is like a glacial change, this is something that you know, that you want to move towards.
I mean, I believe in mandatory paternity and maternity leave.
Right.
You know, for that exact reason, because then that's the only way you're going to remove the stigma.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then so you know, I'd be willing to accept that these were kind of glacially slow changing things at the top, that we have these structural problems which had to do with, you know, one of the structural problems has to do with sort of perception of women, and I actually think that will change more rapidly. Like, the idea that a woman can be a charge, a woman can be a leader, like, I feel like we're not that far away from that. That's just switching pretty rapidly. But then the other problems are the structural problems, like childcare, and those, you know, those perceptions of who does what in the home kind of change more slowly, but they can change as they do.
And I guess, you know, that going back to sort of especially the questions about education and, you know, girls succeeding at higher rates than boys and that sort of thing, I mean, I think that that is, I mean, obviously those numbers are real, but I also think that that type of success does not really translate into the types of higher up the ladder success that we're talking about. And, you know, and you see that with numbers of women graduates in all sorts of fields, you know, law, journalism, whatever, that where those high graduation rates and you know, high grade point averages just don't translate to workplace success the same way.
Right. Although it's not true, and it's I mean, it's true, and you'd have to break down workplace by workplace. Like mm-hmm. in medicine, you know, women do really well. Like in law, you know, there's endless debate in law schools about why it is that you have all these first year female associates and you don't. You know, you'd need sort of a workplace culture change, which again is one of those things that's happening slowly. You'd need some workplace culture that wasn't based on hours and in which people didn't have to sort of clock FaceTime, and you know, those are things that change, although they do change slowly. But you know, as long as we accept there's nothing immutable about it, there's nothing that, you know, there's no reason that it has to be that way, that women are incapable in some ways of doing, you know, certain jobs or being in certain positions, it's just sort of structural problems, mm-hmm. then you feel like we're heading in that right direction.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, to talk about it a little bit more, you know, in a cross-class way again, is like, I know that you quote Heather Boucher in your piece, and you know, she and I have had conversations too about, you know, she's very worried about the, you know, the crisis in like the male workforce, essentially, mm-hmm. like a lot of what is sort of the core of your piece. But you know, what I don't like about that conversation is it renders invisible the fact that like the jobs that are stable in this economy, or that women are holding, are the ones that are less paid, the ones that are like, you know, the hours are terrible. You know, it's not like those manufacturing jobs lost by men are sort of matched in quality by the jobs that women hold disproportionately right now.
That's true, although I don't think men have it. Those jobs just don't exist for anyone so much anymore, mm-hmm. so it's true. Like, that's the first argument to make against the working class. It's not, you know, women are not getting necessarily great jobs, mm-hmm. you know, and then there's this sort of historical idea that when women take jobs, they become inherently less valued,
sure.
although I'm not sure that's, you know, that phenomenon is a little less sharp than it used to be in the Mad Men era. You know, men used to be secretaries, then once women become secretaries, that becomes a sort of lower order of job. I mean,
sure.
I don't think it happens that automatically anymore, but it is, you know, it is true. And this is something I say also about, particularly about the working classes, that it's, you know, it's not that women are happy. Like, no one says that women are psyched and really happy and gleeful. It's just, you know, it's by virtue of a lot of different laws and changes that they've ended up mostly in charge, and they may not even want to be. But that's just how it is. And so,
but when you say they've ended up mostly in charge, you're talking about in the home.
Yeah, I mean, as Catherine Eden, who I quote in the piece, says, it's not, you know, it's something that she puts it, something that feminists have missed is how much power women tend to have in a non-marital context. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you take this idea that, go back to Ross Douth, that there's fewer and fewer marriages, both because there are no marriages in the first place when children have kids, and I mean when people have children, and sex, you could say children have kids, because, well, actually it's not the teenage birth rate, it's a different conversation, you know, because people don't get married as much, you know, they get divorced,
mm-hmm.
or they just don't get married as much, and so women in that context have a lot of power in terms of, yes, child-rearing decisions, kind of
mm-hmm.
the way the child custody law, the way that, you know, various social welfare programs have gone to women, and then suddenly there's the recession and kind of men are, you know, kind of stuck, you know, without, and also expectations of paternity has changed, and so as she likes to say, you know, it used to be a man in that situation, you know, there wouldn't be any expectation on him, nobody would,
mm-hmm.
would kind of criticize him for not being there for his kids, but now there's kind of the social expectation which the men are unable to reach because they don't have money and they don't have a job and because they don't really have a role model to help them out, so... the question I have been puzzling my way through, which everybody criticizes me about too, and maybe you have a view on, is the zero-sum question. Like,
mm-hmm.
why does it have to be sort of women up, men down, men up, women down?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't yet have a good answer to that question. I'm not. It might be a temporary state. Like, sometimes, you know, there's just limited resources and it is that way, but it doesn't mean it has to be forever.
I mean, I guess I don't see it as, like, this tug of war. I mean, I don't...
Uh-huh.
I think that... this is sort of what I was saying earlier, like, you know, and I think you would agree that these are just big, slow shifts, and,
right.
and you know, and you can't have a group, you know, a population that gains more rights or more power without someone else feeling like they're losing it. I mean, that's
right.
just, I mean, I really think that's true. I mean, look at everything from, you know, the civil rights era to, like, you know, earliest feminist battles. I mean, there's no way to convince people that, that sharing power doesn't diminish their own.
But is that is that inherently a temporary state? I mean, I think now, you know, it's not a you know, you wouldn't say it's a great majority of the country mm-hmm. that, you know, initially in the civil rights era, you could say, you know, more minorities got power, the less whites, you know, whites lost their power. There are certainly still people who would believe that now, but it's not the great majority of people, I don't think.
I mean, I think that that's definitely a more prevalent sentiment when you're in these periods of tension or transition, and I do think it decreases. But I also think that, you know, there are parts of the country now where you say, like, since the civil rights movement, have white Americans lost power? People would say yes, you know, I mean, still. It's not like, you know, I don't feel like those feelings go away. I think, you know, it is true that certain people are born feeling more entitled to things than others.
Right, and I think that is what my answer would be to the zero-sum question now. Like, I would say that this is a period of great transition, and there will be a period when men feel like they're losing power, and women feel, you know, as women gain power in various spheres, and then that, you know, that sort of dies. Eventually it equalizes, and I'm not sure where it equalizes, but it does.
Yeah,
but eventually is a long time.
I mean, with regard to gender, I feel like we've been in this tension transition phase for a really long time. I mean, I don't think that tension or transition is new. That's my feeling. Like, I don't think that's a recession era thing. Like, I think that, you know, maybe we have some better statistics now, or you know, there's new data now about things that, like, you know, like I said, have been happening for a long time. But I think that, yeah, I mean, this is a half a century of this period of tension.
Right. So. I'm not sure I would disagree with that. Although maybe we would disagree about, you know, for me, that, you know, you bring those things together, and maybe it is statistics. Maybe it is just, like I said, the fact that people do talk about, you know, percentage of women who make more than their husbands. But you know, in fact, marriages have changed, like in terms of class marriages and who marries who and what women and men do. I mean, you can track certain changes, you know, since the 70s that are fairly significant. I mean, and you know, that marriage does look very different now than it did, you know, 40 years ago, even if you can say that those changes have been building up over the last 40 years.
Well, once we live in the Douthat regime and we all marry based on our ideals as opposed to who we love and what we want to do with our lives, then, you know, none of this will even matter.
Exactly. All right. On that note, to the Douthat age. well, thank you very much for talking about all of this stuff. This was a pleasure, and I hope we do it again.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.